You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine.
Welcome to this week's episode of Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell. And this week, we're going to take it all the way back to the 1970s, and we are going to talk about the hot dog skiing movement, arguably one of the most important movements in skiing as it paved the way for the free skiers of today. As before the hot doggers came around, the only way to make money in skiing was to be a ski racer, and that meant living a very regimented life. And the hot dog ski lifestyle was not about regiment by any means. It was about having a great time on and off the hill. It was about inventing new tricks. It was about an energy within the ski industry that they hadn't felt in years. And today we have the most iconic skier of that era on the program. He is the 1972 Skier of the Year. He's been a paid professional skier for over 40 years. He's the inventor of the Wong Banger. I'm excited to have in the studio today, Wayne Wong. In from a drive from Reno, we have Wayne Wong here. Wayne, you've been in the car for how long?
About 12 hours.
12 hours?
Yeah, but it was important for me to get here, man.
Yeah, well, I thank you for coming out as you resonate with not only the hot doggers of old, but the generation of skiers today. The Wong Banger and that image that you created. A lot of the skiers think it's just a tail press, which is pretty funny because in reading up on it, it's a front flip, right?
Correct, yeah. It was an accidental move that happened to me when I was younger, and I accidentally hit this real straight transition, and it was like hitting a wall, and I instinctively stuck my poles out in front of me and did a vault and flipped and landed back on my feet. And so I was like, so that's why I called it the Wong Banger, because I banged into this wall and flipped over it.
I thought there might have been a porn reference in there, but I guess there wasn't.
No.
When I look back to those hot dog skiers back in the day, you're the one that really stands out as the icon of that era, although the skiers themselves might think of other skiers that were icons. Who were the ones that really stood out for you?
The guys that influenced me, and I go, wow, you know, I'm watching these guys do stuff on skis. And at that time, Hart Ski Company had the Hart demo team, and they were Art Fuhrer. Was probably the most inspirational guy for me in skiing, just because I watched him in the incredible skis and watching him do all these tricks on skis, and I was absolutely bewildered, as I'm sure a lot of people looked at me back in the 70s and go, wow, how did he do that? Well, back in the 60s, we didn't have any coaches or anybody, so I'd see these films, and I'd go out on my local hill at Mount Seymour in Vancouver, and I'd go and try and learn these tricks on my own and accidentally fall and spin and get up and go, wow, that's a new trick. I invented a new trick. And so it was a very creative part of my life in my skiing career.
And were you ever a ski racer?
I sucked at it, man. I tried ski racing when I was about 12, 13, 14 years old. And I was really not disciplined enough for that. And so I had two options at that time, because I loved to ski, and a lot of the guys got free lift tickets. One, you could be a ski patrolman and get a free lift ticket.
Right.
Or the second would be a ski instructor and get paid to ski as well. So I opted to take a ski instructor's training course with the Canadian Ski Instructors Alliance when I was 16, and that's when my skiing teaching career began.
Okay, and how long were you a ski instructor before you became a full-fledged professional skier?
I went through all the ranks of the Canadian Ski Instructors Alliance and had a level 4 certification and was a member of the Interski team in 1975. And I taught skiing, and I still teach skiing, but not on that certified level.
Okay.
I'd be more of the Wayne Wong, or what we say, ski the Wong way.
Right.
That's what we do.
So what was the ski scene like in the 70s? When I think back to the 70s, I think of the movie Dazed and Confused, and I think it was all about cold beer, smoking joints, and having a good time. What was it for you?
For me, back in the day, it was the creativity, the excitement of doing something that nobody had ever seen before. And for me, it was all about creativity and showing people what could be done on skis beyond the norm of alpine ski racing. And it goes back to, I think, Doug Pfeiffer I owe a lot to Doug Pfeiffer, who at that time was the editor of Skiing Magazine. And he and Tommy Corcoran had this conversation about who the best skiers were on the mountain. And Tommy had just come off the U.S. Alpine ski team and said, well, obviously it's the ski racers who are the better skiers. And Doug Pfeiffer, who being really kind of a rebel in skiing at that time as well, said, you know, Tommy, I beg to differ with you. What about the guys that are skiing bumps and these guys that are jumping and spinning on skis? You know, who really is the best skier? And, well, let's have a competition. And you have this new skier called Waterville Valley in New Hampshire, and we'll host the event. And we'll see who the best skier in the country is, whether it's the Alpine Ski Racers or these free-spirited hot doggers.
And were you at that contest?
I did. I did go to that event, and not really trying to prove anything other than showcase what my abilities were and what I could do on skis. But for me, I was in awe just seeing some of my heroes in skiing walking in the same lodge with me. And guys like Bobby Burns, guys like Tommy Leroy, Susie Chaffee. I mean, I was absolutely bewildered. I was 21 years old when I went to that event. And for me, it was just the coolest thing. I didn't care about winning. I didn't care. I was just cool to be hanging with these guys.
And how did you do there?
That first event, that was the first event ever. And the disciplines weren't defined yet. It was a free-for-all, basically. They had a start gate and a finish gate, and what you did in between was up to you to excite the judges and to excite the crowd. And after the event, we had about 46, 48 competitors, and I'd beaten some of my heroes in skiing, and I ended up winning third place.
Okay, so that's not too bad for your first competition. Yeah. Were you a sponsored skier at that time? Did you have brands supporting you, or were you just Wayne Wong on his own?
It was pretty much Wayne Wong on his own, although one of the local ski shops in Vancouver had given me a free pair of Vocal skis at that time. You know, I wasn't looking beyond anything, beyond just being at the event and participating.
Did you think at that point in your life that skiing could be a career?
Not right then, but for me, it was, I think, a different story as far as my career goes in the fact that I didn't set a goal to become Wayne Wong, the great skier or anything like that. I was very lucky. I was in the right place at the right time, had some great opportunities. And after that first event, I think a lot of the sponsors took notice of the draw that freestyle or hot dog skiing could have for skiing and for the general public. So I was presented with several offers, like with K2, who became my biggest sponsor.
Yep.
And Salomon and Reichley. And it was phenomenal at that time, because I didn't have to seek sponsors. It was great when sponsors came to you and said, hey, we want you to be on our product, and we'll give you all this product, and we can put you on our team, and we'll have a reward and bonus thing for, results.
Yep.
Yeah. So that was kind of it. And when we started the events, the prize money really wasn't there. I mean, I won like $300 on winning the first ballet and mogul, ballet and moguls and aerials. The first place guy would want a $300.
But so that's still like $1,200 today, right?
It may be so in real dollars today.
Yeah.
But most of us really at that time really didn't do it for the money. I think it was all for the guts and glory.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody gets into skiing for the money. They get into it to have fun, and then eventually they realize, hey, I might be able to do something with this. And then when that happens, you're kind of living the dream.
Exactly. And that's what happened to me. I all my friends said, Wayne, when are you going to get a real job? Well, I'm 67 years old almost, and I still haven't got my real office job. I'm still living the dream as far as still being able to make a living in skiing.
It's amazing. You've been paid to ski for, what, 45 years?
Yeah, about that long, yeah.
That's amazing. So you were 1972, you were the freestyle skier of the year.
1972 was a three-venue event, one at Waterville Valley, one at Sun Valley, and one at Vail. And that was the first time they awarded basically the Grand Prix championships, and which became the world champion. And I had taken a second, a third, and a second in combined titles at these three events. So with the overall placements, they awarded me, which was a surprise to everybody, the first ever hot dog skier world champion.
Did you feel like you kind of cheated to get that win because you didn't win any of those contests?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that. I was just very honored that I was presented this award that nobody had ever, even talked about until they had an event at Vail. And I go, this is just more icing on the cake.
Well, one of the big things when I think of Wayne Wong, and I'm staring at your poster right now, is just the image that you created. I mean, that Wong Banger photo, it's everywhere. It really defines what it means to look cool while you're skiing, especially back then because people didn't look so cool. You had the long black hair. You had those amazing glasses, which I actually have a pair of brand new glasses right now that are the ones that you wore, back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And you just had a style that was totally different. Back then, was it something where everybody was trying to pave their own way and create their own style?
Well, I think a lot of for me, again, being Chinese-Canadian, the long black hair and the white sunglasses, and with a name like Wayne Wong, people could identify that quite readily. You know, like the big joke with John Clendenin is he says, if I was John Wong, maybe I would have been more famous than I am today. But again, a lot of these things just kind of, people could recognize me because I was probably the only Asian on the ski.
On the mountain,
really, yeah. Of notoriety. And I had the signature white sunglasses and the long black hair at that time. And so I was readily identified by the public and by skiers on the hill.
Was race ever an issue in your life? Did you ever feel any discrimination?
No, actually, I never felt that at all. Anywhere I went, I was very welcomed. And no, it never became an issue for me.
Yeah, you don't really seem to see too much discrimination in the ski world.
No, that's true. Yeah,
it's a very accepting place. So on the research I've done about you and your life, I found out that you're pretty squeaky clean. They say you don't even say bad words from what I was told.
I am pretty squeaky clean, yes. I have lived a lifestyle in skiing where, I believe image is everything and becoming a role model to younger skiers along the way. And, I didn't do drugs. I, had a good time. I got my high really from skiing and being on the mountain.
But I'm sure you saw a lot of other people doing things like that in your travels. And I want to know, what are some of the crazier things that you saw in that 70s era that you're able to speak about? And I hope you will name names.
Well, back in the day, Dick Barrymore made that movie, The Performers.
Yep.
And the K2 demo team traveled all around the country. And one of my goals after I'd seen that movie, I go, man, that's really kind of my goal. I want to be part of the K2 demo team if they ever have another one. But back in those days, there was the wet t-shirt contest.
Yep.
And that was infamous pretty much around that era in the early 70s. And there were wet t-shirt, whether it was skiing or any other sports activities, there seemed to be wet t-shirt contests, sprouting up everywhere. And, because of what we do in skiing, the lifestyle, the energy that was in skiing, I think that the wet t-shirt contest became really synonymous with hot dog skiing and skiing.
Yeah, that wet t-shirt contest was the first wet t-shirt contest of its kind, the one with those performers.
Correct.
They actually invented the wet t-shirt contest.
I think so, yeah.
And I think it got them in a lot of trouble with the K2 folks, and they were told that they couldn't do it anymore after that first tour.
But, it's all good press. Any press is good press.
And now a brief interruption from our Wayne Wong interview so Stanley Larson can add a little more context on what it was like to be a skier in the 70s. I've got Stan Larson on the line. Stan was a member of that K2 competition team back in the 1970s with Wayne Wong. And when Wayne Wong just said no, Stan Larson just said yes. And Stan, can you tell us about the scene in the 70s and what it was like, not really on the hill, but what you guys did after the hill?
Well, firstly, Mike, it's just way too early in the morning to talk about this stuff. But I always say now, you look back and you go, wow, the 70s, what a weekend. And for that matter, the 80s. But there was, I think, you know, you set the mood first, though, you know, 70s. Why did hot dogs eating happen? And what was, you know, this crazy thing and where did it come from? And, you know, it had to do with the draft and Vietnam War and hippies and, you know, culture of the baby boom and all this stuff. And these few wackos kind of popped out of the mold, you know, and didn't want to do regular sports. And somehow this group of disparate gears came together to, you know, find each other and perk this thing into the sport. A couple of things that are always, I always laugh about is that the first poster that was like a national kind of call to arms, and it was like, who's the hottest of the hottest? Come and strut your stuff. See who's the badass, right? So yeah. All these people show up. Like at Sun Valley, I think was the second contest ever. It was 1971, 72. There were, I think, 35,000 people walked up Warm Springs.
Whoa.
Spring snow, more people than had ever been there. But some guys figured out that you could enter an event for like $75. You wanted to be a mogul or go in the mogul skiing, $75 for the aerial acrobatics, or $200 for all three events, which included ballet. So for $200, you got a 4-day pass. You got invited to all these parties. You get to wear the bib, pick up the chicks, look like someone, even if you didn't even know what you were doing. Free dinners, the whole thing. It was $200, right?
Can't beat that.
Yeah, you can't beat that. One guy, his name was Captain Acid, and he had he wore a full-up cape, black tights, black top, red briefs for underwear, and he had a big A with a circle on it on his chest, like the Anarchy. But, you know, this is 1971, right?
Right.
You know, you think back to these events where, like, they were live television, ABC, Wide World Sports. And, you know, there's millions of people watching this stuff. And, you know, here comes Captain Acid at the top of Upper College. So you got all these people lined up and come up to the start. And this announcer guy, Jerry, Total Stoner Jerry, he was like, hey, okay, what are you going to do, man? So Captain Acid gets up there, and he goes, okay, you see that little tree? Well, I'm going to jump. There's a little jump right there I made, and I'm going to jump out over the banners, over the crowd, and outside, and then see down. I built another jump, and I'm going to jump back in over them, you know, down below. And Jerry's like, wow, dude, this is like – you hear that? And he's holding up, you know, the mic down to all the technical guys and the camera guys and the Bud Palmer. Captain Ass is going to jump out over the crowd. There's a big pause. And then you hear over the announcers, Bud Palmer goes, everybody on the left, move back, move back. To let him go. And, you know, and he jumped out and then he, you know, hit some people and never made it back. Never saw him again. But, you know, that's the kind of whack jobs that came along. And, of course, there was this guy, Beaver Nelson. He's from Salt Lake City. And he was the resident on-tour drug dealer. So whoever, like, won, got the check for, you know, cashed it in, that was the party. That's where the party was, in that room or their house or wherever it was. And there was Beaver to supply all the necessary needs. And he traveled, you know, he traveled on the, you know, chartered plane, the East Coast, West Coast, the whole thing.
So you guys were bringing the counterculture to the mountain pretty much.
Well, yeah, it really was, because, you know, there was skiing was pretty stoic, uptight, and, well, rich white guys who skied, you know, and you think all the way back, World War II, man, you see pictures of, you know, sailors getting married the night before they're going off to, you know, war, right?
And yeah.
And I think some of that kind of, that same thing in the 70s, it set the stage for, like, if I don't do it now, when are we going to do it? Let's go get crazy. And that was a big part of the party scene, you know. And of course, well, the chemicals that were available in experimental drugs at the time. That was just part of the fabric. So there you go.
Yeah, it sounds like a time that all of us would like to be a part of, and I wish the ski industry was still like that. But it's changed a little bit, and we're going to get back to Wayne and find out Wayne's stories. But I know that what you brought to the table, Stan, is a little bit different than what we're going to hear from Mr. Wayne Wong. I still need to get a story. I'm not going to stop until we get a good story of some of the crazy partying that you saw back in the 70s. I know you had to see it. I mean, someone had to throw a chair through a window. Somebody had to, you know, you had to bail somebody out of jail at some point. It had to have happened.
Well, I didn't personally, but there was a lot of stuff going on for sure. And one of the, you know, it didn't happen to me, but at Heavenly, we were doing an event, and one of our guys, Jake Shakespeare, was in charge of building the jumps and stuff. And Billy Killebrewer, Hugh Killebrewer, one of the, I can't remember which one, came up with a helicopter to survey it. And what Jake was waving them off, and they would come closer, and Jake threw a bamboo pole at the helicopter to try to wave them away. Uh-huh. The helicopter flew back down, got the sheriff, and flew back up to the mountain, put Jake in handcuffs, and put him in jail that afternoon.
For throwing bamboo at a helicopter?
Yeah, that's a federal offense.
Okay. Yeah. I did not know that, but I know you can do more than that, Wayne.
Yeah.
So let's talk about one that involved some of the late-night drinking or the story that you heard in the morning.
All right. So one of the things we did at Sun Valley, and it's not that big of a deal, we were at the one of the bars right at the bottom of Warm Springs after training and practicing, and we just going to have a couple of beers with the guys, and a friend of mine had a brand new pair of Fry cowboy boots, and I said, Billy, give me that boot. And he says, what do you want that boot for? Just give me the boot. So he gave me his brand new Fry cowboy boot. I went up to the bartender, I gave him $10. I said, fill this thing up with beer. And so he said, really? And I said, yeah. So he filled it up with beer, and I brought it back to the table. I took a big hit out of it, and I started passing it around the table, and people were going nuts that we were drinking out of this cowboy boot. Well, there was about 10 of us that first night, and then the word has spread and said, hey, Wayne, you guys going to do that tomorrow? And well, yeah, okay, we'll do it tomorrow. So we came about 30, 40 people the next day. It just, the word got out that we were having so much fun doing crazy stuff like that. And who would ever think about drinking out of a cowboy boot? And then at one other event, we were at Park City, and we were drinking out of a buddy's ski boot, which was pretty bad.
Yeah, that's pretty gross.
pretty gross, yeah.
You can just think of liters of sweat all day long, and then you're drinking that and chasing it down with beer. So one thing in reading up on you, I found that you had a summer ski camp that you did up in Whistler, I believe?
Correct, yes.
Was it up on the Horseman Glacier?
No, that was actually on the Whistler Glacier. That was way before Blackcomb opened it up. It was actually the Tony Seiler Summer Ski Camp.
Okay.
And it was really a race camp, and Nancy Green was there, and they decided that you know, hey, maybe we ought to have a look at this hot dog freestyle skiing. And so they put me in charge of the freestyle skiing section of it. And the first year we did it was about, I think it was 1972, somewhere around there. And we had maybe 60 students over three or four sessions.
Okay.
And then the final year that I did the camps, we had like 120 kids each session.
Wow.
Yeah, taking freestyle. It was kind of a cool thing because everybody wanted to come and learn how to do some of the tricks that I had invented. And one of the guys, my real claim to fame is not my skiing. There was this kid that came to camp, wanted to be a freestyle skier, and asked me what I did in the summer for training. And at that time, I was into my 10-speed bike, and I would ride my bike around, and that's what I really enjoyed doing on the off season. And so this kid went home and started riding his bike. He was 14 years old or something at that time. And then the next thing I know is one of my fellow coaches says, "Hey, Wayne, you're mentioned in this cycling magazine." And I said, why would I be mentioned in a cycling magazine? Well, this 14-year-old kid said that he owes his career in cycling to you because you had told him that, you know, to train, you did the cycling. And this kid went on to win 3 Tour de Frances.
No way.
And his name was Greg LeMond.
Wow, that's crazy. That is a claim to fame right there. Have you ever run into him after the fact?
I have. I've had the occasion to ski with him several times up in Montana.
Okay.
And meet with him every very, you know, sporadic meetings here and there. But the last time I skied with him was up in Montana a couple of years ago.
Is that at the Yellowstone Club?
Correct. Yeah.
And what's that experience like?
It is like heaven.
I mean, it's a private resort that you have to pay a shit ton of money to be a part of, right?
Yes, and it's pretty unique in a sense that you have to have a pretty good bankroll to participate and be a member there.
Okay,
but the philosophy behind there is for people who don't want to be recognized, don't want to be hassled at a conventional ski resort area. So they really protect the privacy of the membership there.
Okay.
And as a result, they don't, you know, have a whole bunch of people on the mountain every day. And so the runs are virtually empty. And you can ski. I remember getting up one morning, and it was 10 o'clock. And we skied Sunset Boulevard over there, and there was 10 inches of powder and not a track on it yet. At 10:30 in the morning, so my wife and I, just the two of us, skied down there. It was absolutely, unbelievable. And it was one other time I was skiing, and it was very eerie. I was riding up Lake Lift, and I was the only one on the lift, and this was the middle of the day, and I didn't see another soul skiing underneath me. I was just like, I was at my own private ski area all by myself and not another person there.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Do they make you pay that membership fee, or do they let you come on in?
I was very fortunate. I was asked to come in as a guest and ski with some of their membership.
That's awesome. I think Scott Schmidt does that as well.
Scott Schmidt, is a local. And Warren Miller really was the original ski spokesman for the Yellowstone Club.
Gotcha. Do you know how much it costs to be a part of that?
At that time, you had to buy a building lot, and be a property owner. And that time, back in when they started, it was about $1 million. And, homes there are $50, $60 million. And there's some spectacular homes there.
Tough to afford on a professional skier salary, but but it's awesome when you're a professional skier and you get invited.
Yeah, that's the best part about it, yeah.
You know, skiing, how do you feel about skiing now? You've been doing it for 45 years. Are you still as in love with skiing as you were when you started at 11 years old?
I am. I have such a passion for skiing. It was all about when I first started, it was just the thrill of being on the snow, and then the excitement of teaching skiing, and then the excitement of getting into freestyle skiing and being sponsored. And, and during those years, I had an opportunity to help develop product and, test skis and stuff. And I was able to do ski tests and stuff like that. As I look over my career, as I'm getting older, I'm trying to become more a finesse skier and really try to work the bugs out and try to look for that perfect turn.
Okay.
So every day that I'm on the hill, it's a new day for me. I'm it's like it's all fresh. I'm saying, if I try this a little bit different, if I move my body a little bit different, if I have this ski here and I have that there, what can I feel that's not there yet?
Okay.
And so that's the excitement for me, is just still discovering feelings on skis that may be different than I've experienced over the last 50 years or so.
What's missing in skiing now?
I think a lot of the for a while there, the skiing just got a little bit too fragmented. I think when snowboarding came in, it really kind of fragmented the whole skiing. But as a snow sports industry, I think it's wonderful. And a lot of the people were experimenting with snowboarding, and then the skiers started trying snowboarding. But there's a swing back, there definitely is a swing back and forth. And, technology has changed. My first ski boots were rubber. I had metal edges that were screwed onto my wooden skis. And nowadays, you know, I'm working with new technology, and I'm having a really great time with it.
Do you follow any, like, over the past 20 years, are there any skiers that you've followed their careers and kind of just been aware of what they're doing?
What I still look at, and I look back, not really look forward so much, but, you know, the late, great Stein Erickson was certainly a man to, you know, idolize in skiing. And I look, you know, I still look back at the people that influenced me in skiing and made me think about what I do on skis and what I feel on skis. And that has allowed me to progress and try to make myself better.
Okay.
Yeah.
But are you aware of, you know, the younger generation of skiers coming up, you know, the Sean Pettits out there and, you know, the Seth Morrisons?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the greatest honors I had was appearing on Powder Magazine's cover of the 40 greatest skiers of our time back in 2006.
Yeah, I remember that one.
And that was so cool to be standing amongst all these young skiers and go, wow, I've seen their name on skis. I've seen them in the magazines and stuff. So, yeah, I'm very aware of, you know, some of the new skiers. And, yeah, I really admire the athleticism of all these young skiers taking it really to the limit and beyond. And it's just like when we started, we were pushing the limits and we were going, oh, this is no big deal. You know, we're just seeing what we can do on skis. And people were saying, you guys are crazy. How do you do that? And now I look at, you know, all these guys and see them twisting and rotating. And I go, how the hell did they do that?
It's amazing how that comes full circle.
It does. It does. Yeah.
You know, the difference between the guys today, though, and I think your era is you guys really affected pop culture with just the styles of clothing that you were wearing and the things that you were doing. And you could see those, you know, the glasses that you're wearing in the Wong Banger. I mean, that became a national trend. Was that cool to see that you guys were the start of that?
Oh, absolutely. And I love it because even to this day, people, when I'm on the hill or just even socially that I meet people, come up to me and say how much they appreciate what I've done for the sport of skiing, how it actually changed their lives, gave them direction, motivation. And it's really humbling to hear that, you know, after all these years. And people, you know, they come up and say, I had your poster hanging on my wall, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I have your poster hanging on my wall right now.
It's great. Yeah.
So I want to do a little image consulting because as when we look at you and I stare at that poster, I see one of the coolest skiers of all time right there in the Wong Banger photo. What I see with Wayne today is a different Wayne Wong. You know, I look and I see the coolest skier ever back in the 70s. And today you're wearing a helmet that is a little different than other helmets. It's got, you know, part skier, part astronaut look to it. And I know it's functional, but it doesn't show the long black hair. And then I see your skis, which are totally different than any skis I've ever seen before. And they have suspension. It's almost like a motorcycle suspension on the skis. And I can see that they're totally functional because I've watched some of the product videos. I look at Wayne Wong as the cool Wayne Wong. And then I look at Wayne Wong today as more robotish. And have you ever looked at the picture side by side and been like, what happened to my look?
Well, you know, I was 21 years old and, you know, when that post, 22 years old when that poster was taken and, you know, still in my youth. But I've matured like most people and I've learned to appreciate the sport and what the sport has given me. And one thing I do... And don't take this poorly, but my hair has always been my trademark.
Yep.
And I was remembering one of the first times I wore a helmet, and I was talking to Warren Miller for 5 minutes on top of the mountain. And because I had my goggles on and my helmet on, finally he said, Wayne, is that you? And I go, oh, there's the light goes on. So this last year... You know, because of what I do in skiing, it's self promotion. You want to make people know that you're still out there. So, on the occasion now, I go out without a helmet just so that people know and oh, there's Wayne Wong, because they recognize me by my hair. If I had my helmet, other than that shiny chrome one that I've had, it's more recognizable with my hair and my white sunglasses on the hill.
Well, I think I'm an advocate for helmets, and I think everybody in the world should wear them except for Wayne Wong, who should never wear a helmet, and he should always have those sunglasses on. I don't ever want to see you in goggles or a helmet.
Yeah, I try not to wear goggles, but, you know, I realize that, you know, in what I do as far as skiing, I need to let people know that I'm still around, and if I hide my trademark hair underneath a helmet, although my hair is a little grayer now, it's not as black, but it's still long and shaggy. That's what it's all about. You got to let people know that you're still around and on the mountain.
Yeah, it's like when I see you with a helmet on, the image is kind of taken away. It would be like if Glenn Plake shaved his head.
Correct. Absolutely, yeah. And then as far as technology goes, I've been working with his inventor, Anton Wilson, out of New York, for the past 10 years, and he's this wacky engineer.
They all are.
Yeah, they are. I mean, he thinks on a higher level, but it takes somebody, you know, on that wacky level outside of the box to come up with new technology.
For sure.
And what I've seen in skiing is that ski engineers have been trying to figure out certain elements of the characteristics of the ski that they haven't quite hit it. And Anton came up with this idea of suspension. And, you know, ski engineers have been trying to figure out how to dampen the ski to eliminate chatter and vibration on a ski and try to build it into the ski itself.
Yep.
And when I saw this invention that Anton had come up with, this platform that was actually on top of the skis and very functional, and it really achieved what the engineers have been trying to do. It looks a little funky. It looks a little bit different, but everybody says that about anything that's new. And obviously, we're trying to redesign a little bit to be a little bit more streamlined.
What Wayne's saying, you can actually see on the internet. It's really amazing technology, and Wayne's 100% behind it, and you can watch the videos and see how well it works. Just in terms of where skiing's going, what do you think is next, Wayne?
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that the front side skis are coming back more into vogue. I like the fact that, you know, the fatter, wider skis allow a lot more people to get off piste a little bit and, you know, be able to maneuver the skis around a little bit easier. But in reality, in my opinion anyways, they lacked a little bit of the performance standpoint where the skis really engage aggressively onto the snow.
Okay.
And I think a lot of skiers miss that and are starting to, the trend is starting to, for them to come back. And my skiing, at least as far as what I've been trying to do, is really feel the skis engage by making the skis carve. I am not a powder hound. I am a G-force junkie. And to describe that is when you get the ski laid over in an arc and it just sucks you through that turn. It's a feeling that you really don't get until you really feel that ski engage and hook, what we call hook up.
Yep.
And zing right through the turn with very little effort. The ski is so loaded in that turn that it creates some G-forces. And when I go out skiing, that to me is what I'm looking for. I mean, give me a foot of powder or a fresh groom corduroy heel. I'll take that fresh groom corduroy any day, because when I get that ski laid over and get that G-forces going and the ski's just slingshotting from turn to turn, it is an amazing feeling.
Wayne, you're going to be the only person on this show that says, give me a fresh foot of powder or some fresh corduroy, and I'll take the corduroy, which leaves the powder for us, which is good as well.
Yeah, leave me the corduroy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Wayne, I want to thank you for coming out. You really are that one skier from that era that has really resonated with the skiers of the era today. It's great to always talk to you. You're never going to be out of the public's eye, because when we see that Wong Banger photo, it just reminds you of all the fun that skiing is.
Yeah, that's true. And I really appreciate being here and reaching out to everybody. And just look for me on the mountain. I'm out there still, man. Just look for that black hair and the white glasses.
It's only going to be gray.
A little gray and black now.
A little bit, but it's only going to be one day a week because he's wearing a helmet the rest of the days.
Yeah.
We're going to start an online petition to get Wayne Wong out of a helmet. We will pay for any medical treatment he needs if he hits his head. But we need to see the Wong banger look in full effect. And thank you, Wayne Wong, for coming out. And we will see you next time we're in Neshoba Valley.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you, Mike.
Hey, thank you, man. Take care.
All right.
So that was my conversation with Wayne Wong, a.k.a. the Wong banger. Always amazing to have an icon like Wayne in the studio, and I'll let you know he will be the only 67-year-old guest we have on the program all season long. So thanks, Wayne Wong. I also want to thank Stan Larson for letting us know about the counterculture element within the ski industry in the 1970s. And you can find more with Wayne Wong on the Inappropriate Questions podcast on thepowellmovement.com. That's live now, and Sean Pettit, our guest last week, came up with 3 inappropriate questions for Wayne. Wayne will answer those and come up with 3 inappropriate questions for our guest next week. As always, if you have any questions for future guests or any show feedback for me, you can reach me at PowellMovement1 on Twitter, or you can shoot me an email at mike@thepowellmovement.com. Next week, we have another great guest. His name is Colby West, and he was on top of the ski industry in the mid-2000s. We'll talk to Colby about what that was like and what he's up to now. Thanks for listening to Sponsored, and we'll talk to you next week.